In pre-COVID times, July in New Orleans meant Tales of the Cocktail. Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we're serving up a taste of that experience. We begin with a tour of the Sazerac House, a liquor-laden Disney World for historians and cocktail lovers alike. So I touch the screen.
Hey, darling. You look like you could use a drink. I'll just give you a minute. And if you need me, just give a holler.
Then we revisit our conversation with the legendary Jimmy Russell of Wild Turkey Bourbon. The octogenarian has been in the business so long, he remembers a time when labels were an innovation.
You know, us old men, we knew where our bottle sat on the shelf, and we'd go get it, pay for it, and get home. If you changed position on the shelf, we got home with the wrong bottle.
It's Tales time on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A federal judge is considering Oregon's request for a restraining order against federal agents whom officials accuse of arresting people with no probable cause. Despite Oregon's objections, President Trump sent in federal agents to put down civil rights protests that broke down into nightly clashes. Oregon argues the federal presence has actually made matters worse. Trump, who describes himself as the law and order president, says he's doing what local leaders are too afraid to do. With the president prepared to send federal agents into city streets across America, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot is divided. On one hand, she says she doesn't want a Portland-style deployment and threatened to take Trump to court over it. But on the other hand, Lightfoot says Chicago could use the FBI's help to investigate a recent spate of gun violence, including a mass shooting outside a funeral home in Chicago's South Side. Today, the mayor had a message for witnesses. If you know something, say something.
We are the people who will change this narrative. But we need to step up in this moment and encourage others with information not to be silent.
Today, one particular city has the administration's attention for much different reasons. The U.S. has shut down the Chinese consulate in Houston, alleging espionage. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
In justifying the consulate shutdown, a State Department spokesperson alleged China has engaged in, quote, massive illegal spying and influence operations throughout the U.S. China alleges the U.S. broke an international treaty after it confiscated and searched Chinese diplomatic parcels on two occasions. China has threatened retaliation, including potentially shutting down an American consulate in Hong Kong. The U.S. operates consulates in six other Chinese cities, including Wuhan, where the consulate temporarily closed after a coronavirus outbreak. The American consulate in Wuhan was meant to reopen, but remains shut after the U.S. refused to agree to quarantine and testing requirements under which evacuated U.S. diplomats could return to China. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
The administration is proposing new greenhouse gas emission standards for airplanes. NPR's Jeff Brady reports they mirror international standards that environmentalists say are too weak.
Most of the Trump administration's focus has been on rolling back environmental regulations. But this one would reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from airplanes that are changing the climate. Aviation accounts for about 2% of all human-caused greenhouse gases. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler says this proposal will make it easier for domestic manufacturers to sell their planes to other countries.
This regulation will help ensure that older, less efficient airplanes are replaced by newer, more efficient models.
Environmental groups want more aggressive emissions reduction targets. With air travel down because of the coronavirus pandemic and more government help in the offing, they say this is a good time to rebuild the industry with even cleaner planes. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
This is NPR. The U.S. House is preparing to vote on a plan to remove statues from the Capitol of historical figures linked to slavery and the Confederacy. NPR's Joss Snyder reports on the vote schedule for this afternoon.
The bill the House is set to vote on would remove nearly a dozen statues of people who voluntarily served the Confederacy. It would also remove a bust of Roger B. Taney from the old Supreme Court chamber. Taney was the Chief Justice who wrote the majority opinion in the 1857 Dred Scott decision. The bill calls for his bust to be replaced with a bust of Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American to serve as a Supreme Court justice.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. The State Department's internal watchdog has been asked to review an alleged request made by President Trump to his top diplomat in London. U.S. Ambassador Woody Johnson reportedly told colleagues that President Trump asked him to check with the U.K. to see if they could help move the lucrative British Open tournament to Trump's Turnberry Golf Resort in Scotland. NPR's Frank Langfitt has the latest from London.
When Johnson told colleagues about Trump's request, they advised against it because of the ethical problems of advancing the president's business interests. But Johnson went ahead and raised Turnberry hosting the Open with David Mundell, then the Secretary of State for Scotland, according to a source with knowledge of the meeting. Mundell declined to discuss the meeting and referred the New York Times, which broke the story, to a statement from the British government that Johnson, quote, made no request of Mr. Mundell regarding the British Open or any other sporting event. The claims have been forwarded to the State Department's Inspector General. The State Department said it stands by Johnson and that he has led the embassy honorably. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, London.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru, with the 2020 Subaru Forester, featuring standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and safety technology. Love, it's what makes Subaru, Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.
Did you miss your favorite KRVS program? Well, we've got you covered. Visit krvs.org. Scroll over Audio on Demand, select your favorite program from the list, and find an archive of past episodes. Listen anytime, anywhere.
The performance styles and traditions of African-American gospel and Hebridean psalm singing have been explored and celebrated with choirs from Alabama and the Isle of Lewis. We'll hear some creative exchanges this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Until 2020, to every bartender, bar owner, distiller, and cocktailian, the third week of July meant Tales of the Cocktail, the annual international gathering that has dominated the beverage industry scene for the past 16 years. This year, New Orleans bars remain shuttered, and their future seems uncertain. And the 2020 Tales of the Cocktail, planned as a virtual online event, has been postponed until late September. But don't worry, this week's Louisiana Eats is guaranteed to satisfy your tales itch for an hour at least. We begin with New Orleans' ultimate liquor experience, the Sazerac House. The multi-million dollar three-story interactive museum, opened last fall on the corner of Canal and Magazine Street, is a liquor-laden Disney World for historians and cocktail lovers alike. We'll take the full guided tour, including a peek at the first distillery ever located smack in the middle of downtown New Orleans. Then, we'll revisit some of our favorite interviews with Tales attendees from years past, including Jimmy Russell, who's been making wild turkey bourbon for over 60 years, and Kate Gerwin, a red-headed tattooed marvel who was the first American and first female to win the prestigious Bowls Around the World competition. So pour yourself a stiff one and take a seat. It's Tales time on this week's Louisiana Eats. Located at the intersection of Canal and Magazine Streets in New Orleans, the historic Sazerac House is an elegant Italianate-style building erected in the 1960s. the grand structure sat vacant for over three decades until 2017, when the Sazerac Company began renovation to make it the new home place for their company. Today, it holds their head offices, an event space, retail shop, micro distillery, and three floors of what they call a spirited experience. Featuring life-size videos, virtual reality bartenders, and interactive displays, the Sazerac House is a whimsical booze museum that would make Walt Disney proud. It presents the story of New Orleans cocktails as told through the Sazerac Company's own brands, a story that takes us back to the 19th century.
I am Rhiannon Enlil, the experienced team leader at Sazerac House. So here we have the very start of your spirited experience. So welcome.
Thank you.
Please take a spot on a floor cling, and I'll introduce you a little bit to what this room is and the importance of this being the start of our journey together. Against the back wall, we have two important exhibits that explain coffeehouse culture of New Orleans in the 1800s, as well as pharmacies and apothecaries in New Orleans in the 1800s. Because both of those words, we now have different definitions for them. We know coffee houses, go work on my laptop, get a cup of joe, maybe read the paper. But in New Orleans back then, a coffee house was a sophisticated place for drinking. We had bars and saloons and taverns, but a coffee house was where you would go if you wanted to conduct business and network and have fancy drinks, essentially what we would think of today as cocktails. Pharmacies, as well as coffee houses in New Orleans, were places to get medicinal alcohol. At the time, pharmacists believed that putting different botanicals into spirits might have some cure-alls, might be able to cure some ailments. And one in particular pharmacist, a very, very famous one by the name of Amedee Peychaud, is a key player in the story of the Sazerac cocktail. So what we would do is introduce our guests to this space. You would be able to walk around, take as many photographs as you like. I'm here to answer all of your questions. And then in a moment, about 5 minutes from now, I will shepherd us into the next room, which is our apothecary. So we're entering into Peychaud's apothecary, or what we refer to as our bitters experience. So the importance of bitters in general is that if you think about that word cocktail, we now use it to describe any number of drinks that have different combinations of alcohol. But in the 1800s, the word cocktail was defined as a spirit of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters. So if you want to be really technical, it might not be considered a cocktail unless it has bitters.
So here we are in what feels like an old apothecary shop. And there are these bins along the wall. Let's see, there's gentian, star anise, fennel,
celery seed, angelica root, bitter orange peel. So all these different ingredients are the different botanicals, herbs, roots, flowers, dried citrus peels, all the different ingredients that would go into a proprietary blend of bitters. It's almost like a giant spice rack. Every pharmacist would have their own blend. It's kind of like if you have your own red sauce or somebody has their own barbecue sauce. There were bitters for all these different regions throughout the world, and there were different popular bitters in different areas. New Orleans had Peychaud's bitters. It was the most popular brand of bitters here, and it is the longest surviving original brand of bitters in the city of New Orleans. And it is, in fact, one of the key ingredients in the Sazerac cocktail. So much so that in the legislation that was passed in 2008, making the Sazerac the official cocktail of New Orleans, it calls out Peychaud's by brand name.
You can't have a Sazerac without Peychaud's bitters.
You cannot have a Sazerac without Peychaud's bitters. So this room is where we learn about the origin of Sazerac, that word, who it was, what it really comes from. And it starts with a gentleman by the name of Bernard Sazerac. And essentially, the Sazerac Deforge family was making their own cognac. We have some beautiful old bottles of the original Sazerac cognac behind me, as well as artifacts from the family itself. So these are legitimate Sazerac family heirlooms. We were able to work with the descendants of that family to sort of build out this exhibit. You learn a lot about, you know, how far back it stretches. So with Sazerac's cognac, which was imported to New Orleans, and it was extraordinarily popular, so that a particular coffee house, remember coffee house?
Yes.
So the particular coffee house decided they were going to change the name to the Sazerac House, essentially to advertise to the community that if you wanted the Sazerac cognac that everyone loves so much, you could always get it at the Sazerac House. So this room really kind of traces the evolution of where that word is. It started as a family, became a brand of cognac, became a popular drinking establishment in New Orleans. And then inside that drinking establishment, we now see Sazerac cognac. And just down the road, Mr. Antoine Peychaud was advertising you can get his bitters there. And if you remember the definition of a cocktail, spirit of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters. Well, at the Sazerac House, if you asked for a brandy or cognac cocktail, they were going to reach for Sazerac cognac, sugar, water, and Peychaud's bitters. It starts to come together to form the cocktail. The cocktail will eventually evolve and turn into the company, and the company will eventually become the number one spirits producer in North America. One of the fun little surprises that occurs starting in this room are these magic mirrors. They're these huge mirrors that as you walk closer, it will sense your movement and trigger a fantastic animation and music.
Incredible. So you don't even have to touch.
It will do two different cycles. And then each one of these mirrors will have one or two different visuals to just sort of surprise and delight.
It is just like the Disneyland of cocktails, isn't it?
It really is.
So what's next?
All right, let's take a walk over to the sample station and get a little taste of a Sazerac cocktail. And be careful, that film will trigger if we hit any of the spots over there.
Okay.
As we continue down and around the subsequent floors, more amazing alcoholic artifacts were revealed, as well as Disney-esque interactive kiosks, including a virtual bar where I had a virtual cocktail, a whiskey mule at Miss Marie's Lounge. So I touch the screen.
Hey, darling. How's it going? You look like you could use a drink. I'll just give you a minute. And if you need me, just give a holler. My name's Marie.
A whiskey mule.
Whiskey mule, you got it.
There were also more COVID-19 safe and kid-friendly sample stations, serving freshly squeezed lemonade for the kids. Finally, back on the ground floor, we were handed off to David Bach, production manager and head distiller of the Sazerac House, who led us through the distillation process.
This is the production side of the Sazerac House. We are actually producing Sazerac rye whiskey. This is what it takes. We tried to fit it all into this tiny, narrow space that you see around you. Behind you, Poppy, what you'll notice is this is our Sazerac Rye bottling line. All the bottles of Sazerac Rye that you purchase here at the Sazerac House are bottled here on site. Sazerac Rye, like Rhiannon was saying, is primarily three grains. For it to be a rye whiskey means that it needs to be at least 51% rye grains. The other two grains in there are corn and barley. We bring those grains in right here in our large grain handler. It looks like a massive piece of equipment that can crush you. Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah.
So we bring in 1,000 pounds of grains right here in large super sacks and hang them over here over our auger. Turn the auger on, and it'll drop them into one of our four cooking tanks, which are these really shiny, pretty tanks right here. Inside these tanks, we'll have warm water. What we're going to do is we're going to take that carbohydrate molecule that can be found in grains, and we're going to break it into simple and complex sugars. Once we have a big sugary sweet mess, we add yeast on top of that, and the yeast eats the sugar and turns it into booze and bubbles, ethanol and CO2. So what happens is once the fermentation is done, we'll send it down through the bottom of the tank, over the doorway, and into our still. Sazerac rye is a double distillate, which means I'll take that spirit, run it through the still once, collect it over here, and then take it and put it back in the still and run it a second time. On that second time, the alcohol will come across in three phases, the heads, the hearts, and the tails. Once we have that good amount of hearts, it'll be about 160 proof. We'll add water to it to make it barrel strength, and then we'll pump it from these tanks into a barrel where it'll sit for 6 years. We have been here since October of 2019. And so through that process, we have been producing alcohol. Each one of those large tanks, one of our 1,000-gallon fermenters and cookers, will produce one barrel of whiskey. So we're producing, not as fast as they do in Kentucky, but we're definitely producing alcohol and making it making the best beer we can down here. And the great part is being able to see those streetcars come right behind the still as you're sitting here working. You know, it's really pretty to be in this location at the corner of Canal and Magazine. You get to see all the people walk by and ooh and ah, that pretty, pretty still.
That was Rhiannon Enlil and David Bach of the Sazerac House. Coming up next, we have a spirited conversation with the Master Distiller's Master Distiller, the legendary Jimmy Russell of Wild Turkey Bourbon. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bill Bolins from the Dirty Rice Show. Dirty Rice is on the air every Saturday evening from 9 p.m. until 11 p.m. So won't you join either myself or my co-host, Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, for the best in Louisiana music, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krvs.org.
Later today on This American Life, Sandy moves out of the city, wanting a life away from other people. Their guide for the new life is her Uncle Bob's life. He was in and out of institutions, diagnosed with schizophrenia, until finally deciding to live in isolation in the desert, where he thrived. So Sandy tries it. The upside to being alone and apart, later today.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group. The Napoleon House in New Orleans French Quarter is now offering dine-in as well as takeout Tuesday through Saturday, including toasty warm moufaladas, gumbo, frozen Pimm's cups, and more. They may be reached online at napoleonhouse.com and at 504-524-9752. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Master Distiller Jimmy Russell is a rare bird indeed. He's been making Wild Turkey Bourbon in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky for over 65 years. No one else in the industry comes close to that. When we met him at Tales of the Cocktail in 2014, he had just set the record for longest tenured master distiller in the industry. Today at 85 years old, he is the longest tenured active spirits master distiller in the world. Having grown up 5 miles from the distillery, Jimmy was surrounded by bourbon traditions, learning techniques from generations of producers before him.
At that time, it was 4 distilleries in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, and I had families working at all 4 distilleries. All of my family, my uncles and all, my dad actually started out working for the Old Joe Distilling Company, which was an old distillery in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, and finished up working at the Wild Turkey Distillery. My son, Eddie Russell's with me now. He says he's new in the business. He's only been there 33 years now. Most all the people at the Wild Turkey Distillery has been there. Our average length of service right now is about 180 employees. It's 25 years service average. It's all tradition, family with Wild Turkey. We consider ourselves the traditional family way of making Wild Turkey bourbon.
So who was your mentor at Wild Turkey in the early days?
Well, Mr. Bill Hughes was a master distiller when I went there. And he was a young distiller for Prohibition. And he come back and put the distillery in operation. I wasn't kin to him or anything, but more or less he took me under his wing. I started out in quality control. Quality control back in that day and time is a little different to us now. You know, we'd go get our samples. We'd run tests on their grains of corn, rye, barley malt, fermenters, and everything we'd run. We might end up in the grain truck shoveling it out before the day's over with. Nowadays in quality control, you go get the samples and you take it to the labs and they do all analysis there. But back in that day and time, you'd done just a little bit of everything.
Tell me, how do you become the master distiller?
Well, I tease and cut up all the time. Nobody else would have the job. No, it was fortunate that he took me under his wing and started training. And he retired somewhere in the middle 60s. And I took over as master distiller. So I've been master distiller since the middle 60s at the Wild Turkey
Distillery. So you were less than 20 years on the job when you got that designation.
Yes. My wife worked at the distillery before I did. She was in administration then, and we were married, and she was working there, and I went to work out there. And then when our children come along, she stayed home and took care of the children.
So you met her at the distillery?
No, we went through school together.
Oh, she was your high school sweetheart?
My high school sweetheart.
That's really, really lovely. I'd like to know about the major milestones that you feel like you came to.
Well, the thing that I see... basically back when I started, everything was bottled at around 100 proof. We didn't have the lower proof products. Now you have the lower proof, but I see a big trend going back to the higher proof products now, not only in bourbons, but scotches and everything else. But the big trend has been is the small batches, the single barrels and things like that. And that's been the biggest trend. And then another thing, you young people, in my age group, old men, they went to their favorite bar in the afternoon, got off of work. They got their bourbon, they got their cigars, and went to the back room and played cards. Nowadays, we run from 21 to my age. Everybody's drinking. And one of the big things to me is you ladies. In my younger days, ladies, unless you're maybe here in Louisiana and Kentucky, you didn't go to the bars or anything. You didn't go to the liquor stores. Nowadays, most of the product is bought by you ladies. And I tease and cut up all the time. You made the labels look a lot better. Us old men, we knew where our bottle sat on the shelf, and we'd go get it, pay for it, and get home. If you changed position on the shelf, we got home with the wrong bottle. Nowadays, if you're like my wife, the labels looks a lot better because you're going to pick it up and look at that turkey. Look at them feathers. What's it say on the back label? You read everything on it. Us old men, we didn't pay attention to that. We just want to know what was inside, drinking what was inside that bottle. And the export market has been tremendous the last. We're huge in Australia and Japan.
Really?
Big markets for us back in late 80s, early 90s. In my beginning, it was a Southern gentleman's drink. It's a worldwide drink now.
Tell us a little bit about how you make bourbon and the important elements that make a great bourbon great.
Well, in bourbons, our federal government tells you how it's the most heavily regulated product in the world. It has to be made from at least 51% corn, has to be distilled under 160 proof, must be put in a new charred oak barrel at 125 proof or less. So in our process, we use less corn and more rye and barley malt. It gives you more body. That's the way traditional old bourbons were made. Your yeast plays an important factor. We have our own yeast at the Wild Turkey Distillery. We make our yeast every day. And all I can vouch for the yeast, it's at least 59 years old. It was there when I got there, and we're still using the same yeast. And some people use corn, wheat, and barley malt, but most bourbon distilleries are corn, rye, and barley.
And there's something a little special about that Kentucky water, too.
You got to have good limestone water, good grains, good yeast, and the formulas. And we have all that. And a good barrel. Very important. We use the number 4 char, the heavy char. We call it the alligator skin. Our storage buildings are 7 stories tall, metal-clad buildings, metal roofs, just rolled in and on ricks. We open the windows in the summertime to get the good air circulation. The wintertime, we close them. We want that barrel to breathe. In the summertime, it expands out into that wood. And when you char in white oak, you're caramelizing the sugars and the vanillas and all. In the wintertime, it extracts in and out. You've got to have that breathing. It's got to move in and out. If it went in that wood and stayed all the time, it wouldn't age. Or if it never got into wood, it wouldn't age. So you got to have that movement in. And the way we age Wild Turkey, in 8 years, we lose about a third of our barrel.
That's what's referred to as the angel
share.
The
angel share. We got a lot of happy angels around our area.
I'm sure they are.
And sometimes I think it's a little different than that, too. We talk about the single barrels. We call those the sugar barrels. The people that work in those storage buildings all the time knows where the best tasting barrels are. And they always have a little piece of hose laying there and little cups that they always get to taste. We lose a lot more than a third out of those barrels. We got a lot of angels working in there. What better can you be when you're in the bourbon business and you get to enjoy the life that you'd enjoy?
I heard that you have been regarded in the industry as the Buddha of bourbon and the master distiller's master distiller. How many other master distillers have you trained during your 60 years?
Well, it's been several of them, but most of them, my son, a couple, three more. They're some of them is retired now, but I'm still.
And you're still working.
Still working every day.
What are you doing? Still working after all these years?
I don't work. To me, it's not a job. It's something I enjoy doing. The first day it becomes a job, I know it's a time to retire.
How do you see your place in America's bourbon world?
Well, to me, I just want to be plain old Jimmy, like I've always been. I don't want to be up any better than anybody else. We're all the same to me. It's one thing I hope everybody sees me is just plain old Jimmy, like I've always been. That's what I want to be.
Well, this has been a distinct and remarkable honor to have this chance to sit down with you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you. Invite everybody to come and visit with us. I hope you'll come and visit with us. And I hope when you do come by the Wild Turkey Distillery, you'll ask the visitor center if I'm there. I'd be glad to come and show you around. I'd be glad to have you anytime or anybody. That's one thing that said I'm plain old Jimmy. I try to say hello to all the visitors, and I'll try to go be out and say hello to them. Or go down to the visitor center in the afternoons and sit around and talk to them. I enjoy being with the people.
That was Wild Turkey's legendary master distiller, Jimmy Russell, speaking to us in 2014. I laid eyes on Kate Gerwin, I could tell she has a way of shattering expectations. From her striking red hair and tattooed head to her astonishing success creating a cocktail scene in Bismarck, North Dakota, Kate has challenged all kinds of industry standards. She's also the first American and first female to win the prestigious Bowls Around the World competition. That's BOLS, the name of the liquor company from Amsterdam that's been around since 1575. Back in 2015, Kate took a break from the spirited scene at the Hotel Monteleone to discuss her career owning and operating award-winning establishments and the story behind her game-changing mentorship program for female bartenders called Girls with Bowls. Kate, you have had a very interesting life because you didn't start out your life in spirits. You started out in wine. So tell me how you transitioned from one place to another.
Well, I grew up in wine country in California, in Sonoma and Napa. So it was just natural in the hospitality industry to gravitate towards wine. I was a cellarette. I used to shovel grapes. I was usually the only female in the cellar. It was physical work, very fun, very demanding. I also worked as a sommelier at some restaurants where I met my ex-husband, who was a chef. And when we decided to open our own restaurant, we moved to New Mexico. And we opened a restaurant which was really supposed to be a fine dining wine-focused restaurant. However, in New Mexico, wine isn't really in the forefront. Cocktails are, especially margaritas, fresh juice cocktails, tequila, things of that nature. So it wasn't really something that I made a conscious decision for. It was something that I kind of started to gravitate towards because that's what my guests wanted. They wanted more cocktails. What I came to discover was that with wine and being a sommelier, I basically am given a creative dish from a chef and an expression from a winemaker, and I have to find a match within what two creative people have created. I have to think about a vintage and a year and a climate and how it's going to have the acidity levels, how it's going to match or complement a dish. When I started really gravitating towards cocktails, I realized that my chef could give me a dish, and I didn't have to struggle to find the right grape varietal or the right region or the right vintage. I could just create a cocktail that had the perfect levels of acidity, the right flavors to complement the dish, and then I got the chance to be creative instead of taking two creative outlets and trying to marry them. I started making my own cocktails, and it was something I never looked back on.
Well, you really got extra good super fast at making your own cocktails because you were the first female champion in 2014 of the Bowls Bartending World Competition. What was that contest like?
It's intense. They call it like the Olympics of bartending because it starts with over 3,000 bartenders from 70 different countries. I mean, it's huge. When they narrow it down to the top 18, it takes 4 months. And 4 months of different levels of competition. It's not just bartending. It's not just creating a cocktail and submitting a recipe. There's menu development. There's operations questions. There's speed and efficiency. So there's all kinds of things. They narrow it down to the top 18, and those 18 are flown out to Amsterdam. From there, there's still a whole nother week of competition. Every day is new challenges. Then they narrow it down to the top 8, which go to what they call the big show. And the big show is televised. It's a huge event. It's on stage. And that's when we get to showcase our bartending skills. It's a little bit more about style and creating the perfect cocktail and entertaining our guests. Because for me, being the perfect bartender is not just about making a good cocktail and walking away. It's about giving the whole experience to a guest and entertaining them. People don't go out to bars to just have a drink. They want the experience. I threw a little style and a couple of things that I do with some pours, and I was very, very blessed. My competition was fierce, and I took home the prize. I was shocked. I definitely cried a lot.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very good work.
Well, you know, when I won the Bowls Around the World Championship, Bowls sat me down and talked to me about my experience and asked me what I really wanted to achieve in 1 year. And when they actually the ones that told me, they said, you know that you're the first female world champion, and not just for Bowls. Like, I'm the first. And they said, how does that make you feel? Like, I was supposed to have so much pride. And the first thing I said to them is, I said, it kind of makes me want to cry. And they were like, well, why? Like, that's so silly. And I'm like, no. Women have been bartending for a long time. I mean, Ada Coley and all these people who pioneered women bartending. And I'm the first? Me? That's kind of disappointing. And when we talked about why and the industry standards and competitions especially, we did a little bit of research. And we came to find out that in the United States, over 60% of the bartenders in the United States are women. So over half of all bartenders are actually women. However, when it comes to competitions, only 17% of women are competing. And we kind of broke that down in the idea of that competitions come from a certain level of bartending. It tends to be that women are hired for their assets and
yes,
not their brain. And that, to me, was a big red flag. We needed some strong female mentors in really big markets to pioneer a new path for bartenders, for female bartenders, to learn the craft. So what we did is we started a program called Girls with Bowls. And it was kind of a play for me just to be kind of funny and make a joke about it. We picked pioneering women in 5 different markets, which we're actually expanding now because it's been so successful. And these women take on an active female mentorship role in the responsible mentorship. And we do charity events. We talk about things like family planning because that's something that people don't think about. We can be mothers and be bartenders at the same time. Financial planning, tax processing, things of those nature. We talk about businesses. We talk about health and health insurance and how to get those things. And it's not just for females, but we really try and give the young girls in the industry the idea of this can be a career. This can be a viable way of making money and being happy and not giving up the rest of your life and really being successful in it. So I just kind of feel like we're pioneering something new.
So tell me a little bit about, really and truly, Kate, how did you get to Bismarck?
Believe it or not, Bismarck is one of the largest booming economies in the U.S. right now. They do have a huge oil boom, a very surging and growing economy. They're expected to grow over 10% in the next 5 years, which is a lot. The industry itself, there's a doctor who is in Bismarck. He's also a state legislator, and their liquor licenses are released 1 per 10 years, and he happened to get his hands on the one new one. Well, such a booming economy and one liquor license, you want to go big or go home. Yeah. I mean, you do. You're like, I'm going to do something and I'm going to do it big. And it's been amazing because I think for me, the benefit, people ask all the time, why are you in North Dakota? You know, world champion. And I tell them all the time is, you know, being able to change and see the change in the way a culture drinks is one of the most gratifying things I could ever explain. You're in New York. Everyone knows, most people, they know their drinks. On every corner, there's a craft cocktail bar. Being able to walk into a small market and introduce the differences in ice, the difference in a fresh juice versus sour off a gun, and actually changing the way an entire community views the way they're drinking their cocktails is amazing. And it's not that you want to be the only one in a small town doing something, because then you're just one cool place. It's when you see the change in the guests, and then the other bars start to change, and the other bars start to adopt your tactics. Because it's not a competition. You want to raise the bar for everyone, because then that's when you really get well known. So it's the simple things like we make our own tonic. Well, the first couple weeks, people come in and they order the tonic, a gin and tonic, and they look at them, well, this is brown or this is that. And then you explain to them the process. Well, we use cinchona bark and this is a natural tonic. Then a month or two later, people are coming and going, you know, I can't drink gin and tonics anywhere else because they're understanding what they're drinking. Next thing you know, other bars around town are adopting those practices. So it's one of the most satisfying things about being a bartender is walking in to an area and without being pretentious and without pointing out what you're saying they're doing wrong, because they're not doing anything wrong. They're just doing something different.
Right.
But being able to change that kind of market is one of the most gratifying things.
What was the time period that you estimate it took to start to see things turn around?
4 to 6 months.
That fast?
So fast.
That's shocking.
So fast. We're a population about 80 to 90,000. So it is a small community. We're travels.
Well, Kate, when you and I hadn't met each other and we were rendezvousing out at the wild party in the street in front of the Monteleone, you said, oh, you really can't miss me. I have red hair and my head's tattooed too. So this is quite a look. You're working
it
here.
It is.
Tell me about this look that you've got going on.
Well, I've always had tattoos. I love tattoos, clearly. But I never actually had them in what I call scene territory until I owned my own business, until I became successful. Not because of myself, but just understanding. You know, preconceived notions and things like that. When I felt like I had finally really established who I was and that I knew that I was confident in my actions and my mind and my brain and my power, I started doing what I had always wanted to do, was tattooing, you know, my arms and things like that. At first, it was a little difficult. At first, it was different as people reacted to me and I could see the reactions. But now I love it. I own it. It's part of who I am. And part of the things I love about it is I like being underestimated. I like it when people meet me and they kind of like look up and down and then I start to talk and they're like, oh my God, she's really smart and I can learn from her and she's fun and, you know, she's not pretentious and she has a really good time.
Well, Kate, this has been such an incredible pleasure. So
well, it's been great.
I look forward to seeing you again
and you
again
won't miss
at Tales of the Cocktail.
I'll be here every year.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
That was celebrated mixologist Kate Gerwin speaking to us in 2015. What is a Pousse Café? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. What a strange thing to say.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon here on KRVS.
Hey everybody, it's Drake with the Franco Mix on 88.7 every Thursday night at 9. N'oubliez pas, c'est formidable. Yeah, n'oubliez pas encore de écouter le Franco Mix chaque jeudi soir sur KRBS 88.7 avec Drake LeBlanc. Say for me, Dabla.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission, Louisiana's North Shore is turning up the heat for the annual Tammany Taste of Summer. Plan your escape to St. Tammany Parish for delicious adventures from August 1st through September 30th. Learn how to get your own Tammany Taste of Summer Pass by visiting TammanyTaste.com. Louisiana's North Shore, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is a Pousse Café? A Pousse Café is an elaborate drink that's a throwback to the 19th century, something that hasn't quite made its way back into modern cocktail culture. It consists of 10 or 12 layers of liqueur, each a different color, stacked carefully, one on top of the other, creating a magical rainbow effect. Originally, it even had its own stemmed glass. Again, something you're not likely to see anytime soon. The layered effect is created when the bartender gently pours each liqueur over the back of a spoon. The flavors vary, but often include grenadine, maraschino liqueur, creme de menthe, creme de violette, yellow chartreuse, and brandy. The important thing a bartender has to know is the viscosity of each, because that's how you get the floating trick to occur. If you grew up in the New Orleans of the 60s and 70s, it's a good guess you remember Nick's original Big Train Bar on Tulane Avenue. Nick's had actually been in existence since 1918, first as a neighborhood grocery that began selling liquor after Prohibition. Proprietor Nick Castrogiovanni was famous for his Pousse Café and claimed to hold the world's record for most layers, having once poured 32 different liqueurs into the pony glasses he preferred. Nick's rebuilt after Hurricane Betsy in 1965, but didn't make it back after Katrina. Good news, though. Nick's Big Train Bar purportedly is coming back to Tulane Avenue. So get ready to belly up to the bar and order a Pousse Café. I'm Poppy Tooker, and a Pousse Café makes for good Louisiana drinks.
Big train, make that whistle sigh. Big train, make that whistle cry. Big train, don't you tell me a lie. Big train, why'd you ever say goodbye?
Hi, my name's Mikey Enright, and I own a barbershop in Sydney.
Mikey Enright's desire to become a barber transported him across the globe to a world of scissors and jiggers down under. Now he owns a combination vintage barbershop and speakeasy-style gin bar in Sydney, Australia, called, what else? The Barbershop. When we met Mikey at Tales of the Cocktail back in 2015, he gave us a glimpse of his innovative business pairing.
I kind of wanted to create an environment that was a day business and a night business. It's very hard to open a cocktail bar in Sydney, Australia, and trade during the day. People don't drink cocktails in the day like they do in New Orleans. And so I wanted to have a day business originally, but also I wanted to combine, you know, the craft of the cocktail with, you know, with the skill of a barber, and then combine those two lifestyles together so that you can have a great drink whilst you kind of get your hair cut or your beard trimmed or styled or whatever you like.
So Have people begun drinking in the daytime, too, because the barbershops open in the daytime?
Yes.
Oh, you corrupter. You corrupter of people just looking for a little trim. So how has that evolved? Tell me about how you've changed that pattern.
Well, you know, the barbershop thing, people started getting haircut at hairdressers and that kind of stuff over the last 20, 30, 40 years. There's a renaissance with the barbershop. You know, guys, generally men, are going back to getting the haircut at barbershops again and having that tradition and that sort of style of thing. So I just wanted to bring that back too, you know. So, and it works harmoniously with the bar. We have lots of different packages where people can have whiskey flights with certain sort of haircuts and whatever they haven't done.
Describe for me how you have seen that culture shift since you're shaking things up.
Well, I think, you know, in Sydney, Australia, the population is very small. You know, it's not like a big city like New York or London where there are lots of people about in the daytime. So, you know, come Thursday, Friday, people do drink in the daytime, but generally not early week. So, you know, from my side, I wanted to have that day business, but it's a tough one. It's not like the US or Great Britain or Asia in the sense of, you know, there's no free martini lunches going on. Uh-huh. You know, people are very conservative in the daytime and then they kind of let their hair down at night or get a cut.
So what other kind of services do you offer besides haircuts?
Right, okay, we do the traditional hot towel cutthroat shave.
Hot towel cutthroat shave.
Yeah, it's not as scary as what it sounds. Yeah, basically, you know, you get the hot and cold towels, you get moisturised after it, and, you know, we give the closest shave that you can possibly have. It's a really nice experience.
So what other services? Tell me a little bit more about the other things that you all offer.
Well, in Sydney and most parts of Australia, there's a big sort of subculture called hipsters.
Yes, the hipsters. We have them here too.
They're everywhere.
In your book, what's a hipster?
Well, that's an interesting question. Right, okay. A hipster generally is somebody with lots of facial hair. They manage and look after their facial hair. You know, they drink great spirits. Yeah. They eat great food, but they want to look like a down-and-outer. yeah, so basically with the hipsters, you know, they like to, you know, keep their grooming up to scratch, so kind of beard trimming, moustache waxing, and that kind of stuff.
Before you were a cocktail enthusiast and bartender, you were a barber. So how did you set out on that course as your life's work originally?
Okay, you're going to love this one. Basically, when I was growing up in England, I wanted to move to Australia. You know, I love England, but I didn't want to live there. So back in the late 80s, if you basically studied and trained as a hairdresser, they were in demand in Australia. So you could get a visa a lot easily.
So there's the barbershop, but then there's also the bar. So what's the experience like in the bar? I think you have to walk through the barbershop to get to the bar. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, so basically the barbershop is open from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. every day. So, you know, if you arrive at the bar before 8 p.m., then you get to walk through the barbershop and see the guys working and doing their craft. The actual cocktail bar itself is predominantly a gin bar. Yeah, you know, we stock a lot of different gins. We have a lot of different style gin cocktails. The barbershop has three chairs, got 120 capacity in the back. So, you know, we have a pretty good atmosphere.
Sounds like quite a party. So you actually do have the largest rare and modern gin and Jennifer collection.
Yes.
How many gins?
Oh, we've got probably just over 100 at the moment.
And a lot of people may not even know who are listening what Jennifer is. Explain that.
Yeah, okay. So Jennifer is basically the first original gin. Yeah, it's juniper focused. It does have a slightly different taste, but Jennifer came before gin. We have a pretty, you know, sizable Jennifer collection. A lot of those Jennifers that we do have, you can't get in Australia. So we get them straight from Holland, from the House of Bowles. It is very different, you know. Basically, the term Dutch courage comes from Jennifer. Yeah, so when they went out to war, they used to have a slug of Jennifer. Yeah,
and
so
then
that's
you'd
quite
be ready to
fact.
Jump into the battle, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And then you go to war on a nice note.
Well, Mikey, describe for me some of the cocktails that you might be mixing there. What are you doing that's so different and special besides the haircut and a cutthroat?
We pride ourselves on all the best service that we can possibly give, and outside of that, you know, the best ingredients too. With cocktails, you know, we're quite experimental in terms of we use like lots of fresh fruits, and we use custard apple, rhubarb, which is traditionally English.
What's a custard apple? I think a lot of people might not know what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's a hybrid of an apple. It's not something that you could chew on. It doesn't hold much moisture, so you've got to put it through a slow press juicer, and then you get like a kind of fluffy texture of an apple. Oh. It's very soft compared to like, you know, your regular sort of style apple. So it's like a hybrid. So we use lots of interesting ingredients like that. We also, you know, give a bit of a nod back to the historic record of gin cocktails. You know, we do lots of different variations on classic gin cocktails too. At the moment, I'm working on a hair care range.
A hair care range.
Yes. So I'm working with a scent house. So we're looking at putting the scent of gin into hair cream, moisturiser, beard oil, shave cream, and the likes.
Well, that's a regular manly scent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nothing like a little scent of juniper.
Well, I just think that, you know, I think the future is really, from what I can see, is, you know, you broaden that creativity. And as it turns out, a lot of the botanicals that you do find in gin are beneficial, you know, to hair, skin and nails, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's all good for you too.
Mikey Enright, owner of the Barber Shop in Sydney, Australia, speaking to us in 2015. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum has reopened and is ready to welcome visitors into their newly redesigned galleries. Museum hours are 1:30 to 5:30, Monday through Friday. To plan your visit, call ahead for a reservation or book online. We hope to see you here soon. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by The Commissary, Dickie Brennan's latest venture, offering complete family-style meals featuring signature dishes from Dickie's other restaurants and DIY kits for home cooking. Takeout is available Thursday through Sunday at 634 Orange Street in the Lower Garden District. You can reach them at 504-274-1850 or visit online, thecommissarynola.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.